Happy Saturday. It's July 26th, 2025, and you are listening to Morning Meeting. I'm Ashley Baker of New York.
And I'm Michael Haney of New York City.
But first, the news. Trump's troubles with his base continue to intensify. And to think that we have Jeffrey Epstein, of all people, to thank for this. On Thursday, the Justice Department spent an entire day interviewing his associate, Ghislaine Maxwell, as more reports emerged that Trump and Epstein were cozier than the president had led us to believe. Meanwhile, Columbia and Penn have both made settlements with Trump, and our dystopian American summer continues. As usual, airmail is the antidote to it all.
Yeah, it sure is. And we've got a great episode this week, Ashley. You know, first, as many of you who are airmail readers know, Rich Cohen recently published a book about the murder of Jennifer Dulos, a Connecticut mother. It's a book that grew out of his reporting for us here at Airmail. But one mystery that has never been solved is, where is her body? And Rich is going to join us to tell us how, while out on book tour, he's received more than a few tips about the possible location of her body. Then, in the early 2000s, the art dealer Ezra Chalreiki was approached by a man looking to sell masterpieces by many of the art world's great artists. The catch was, they had all been plundered by Nazi officers. Where had they been? As Chalreiki will reveal, every picture is not always what it seems to be. Then, loyal readers of Airmail have come to love our weekly column called The Attention Whore Index, our weekly roundup of the biggest, well, attention whores of that week, and what they did in search of attention. As you can imagine, in these times, there's an excess of candidates desperate to be included, and our colleague George Kalatarakis, who is the keeper of the list, is going to join us to discuss how he chooses those honorees and who made this week's list. And finally, you may know there's a new book out about Gwyneth Paltrow, and my colleague here, Ashley Baker, has read it, so you don't have to, and she's going to join us to tell us what she learned. So Ashley, where would you like to begin today?
Let's start with Rich Cohen, Michael. He has been covering the story of Jennifer Dulos. It is a true crime story that has completely devastated the community of Connecticut where Rich lives and where Dulos had built a family. He is an editor at large at Airmail, here to take us inside the latest developments of that story. Welcome, Rich.
Thank you for having me.
So, Rich, your book has come out. It's called Murder in the Dollhouse, The Jennifer Dulos Story, and it tells the incredibly long and sordid and intriguing tale of Jennifer Dulos, who was a 50-year-old New Canaan mother who was murdered by her estranged husband in her garage 6 years ago. I mean, it seems like you've been inundated by many theories about what might have happened.
Well, there's such interest in this case because it touches on a primal fear, especially where I live, which is Fairfield County, Connecticut, at the most mundane place in your world, which is your garage in your house after dropping your kids off at school, turns into the place where you're murdered, you know, and the response has been huge. And what I did, I think, which hadn't been done, which was go back and really figure out who Jennifer Farber Dulos was to the best of my ability. And I felt like it was just different because most, you know, true crime books are about death and try to make this kind of about life. And I think because of that, and because people feel like they've gotten a connection to Jennifer, a lot of people have reached out to me from all parts of her life. And in the one mystery, you know, that remains is, where's her body? So I've heard from a lot of police and law enforcement people who I couldn't really talk to when I was reporting the book because the trial of Fotis Dulos' paramour was still going on, Michelle Traconis. But now that trial's over and they read the book and wanted to talk to me.
Remind us of what happened to Michelle and what happened to Fotis.
Fotis killed Jennifer. I think he was surprised by the amount of blood in a human person's body. And he had a very hurried cleanup and he took all this physical evidence connecting him to the crime and he shoved it in basically a bunch of garbage bags and brought it north to Farmington where he lived with Michelle. He was a developer. And he brought it to one of the houses he was working on to resell. She met him there. She claimed she thought they were just cleaning up the house, but they were clearly cleaning up the car where Jennifer's body had been. And they were cleaning up all this bloody evidence, which later was found in dumpsters in Hartford, an unusual place. And that's really what tied Fotis Dulos to this crime and convicted him. Fotis Dulos, when he realized he was basically going to go on trial for murder, and he was probably going to spend the rest of his life in prison. He had put up money for bail and he was out. But when the bank did an investigation and found that most of the stuff he put up for collateral didn't even belong to him, belonged to Jennifer's mother. He was basically going to be put in jail because he didn't have the bail. And rather than show up at bail that day, he got in his car. He put pictures of his kids on his dashboard. He wrote an incredibly self-pitying suicide note and he killed himself. So that's, and that happened, you know, so that's really the state of where it is. And then Michelle, who was sort of Fotis's girlfriend, paramour, they called her in the documents. She was sort of left as the person sort of that all the anger and heat of the state, somebody, you know, had to pay for this. It all fell on her. And the fact is that she seemed, when you looked at it, she incriminated herself many times, told things that contradicted. She gave Fotis an alibi. And, you know, it went to trial, which I covered for Airmail. It was just such a strong case by the prosecution. She was sentenced to 20 years in prison, which is really pretty interesting because this is a murder that she wasn't present at. She argues and her people argue she was a victim of Fotis, you know, like Jennifer had been, not as bad as Jennifer, but he was lying to her and manipulated her. But the fact that she seemed to partake in so much of the post-crime cleanup that you cannot look at it without finding her guilty.
You know, Rich, at first glance, to many following this story, it looked like a love triangle gone very, very wrong. But over the course of reporting the story for Airmail and then piecing the stories together, what did you learn about why this might have happened?
Well, part of the blame really is, which is they had this very acrimonious divorce, one of the most contentious in the history of Connecticut. There were 400 legal filings for things like perjury before they even got to the actual divorce part. And I believe that Fotis Doulos was, from looking in him, that he was a psychopath, not like a Hannibal Lecter kind of psychopath, but the kind of person you might never know about that he was a psychopath until something like this happened. Because what he was is an incredible narcissist, and saw, to me, like a definition of evil is you don't see other people as real. You see him almost as like non-character players or whatever in video games, that they're just characters in your life. So you can't have any empathy with them at all. He put a guy like that in a stressful system like the divorce system, and you get a really bad result like this. Jennifer Farber was a successful playwright in New York, who sort of very into her 30s suddenly remembered her original dream, which I call the dollhouse dream, had been to get married, have a lot of kids, have this perfect marriage, move to Connecticut, and she did it incredibly fast, which is also another way people define psychopaths. So she met Fotis, she'd gone to Brown, she went to St. Anne's, she went to Brown. She met Fotis at Brown, he was from Greece, she wasn't that interested in him, but she met him again in her 30s at the airport in Aspen, Colorado. And she started dating him, and now suddenly looks interesting because she's like getting to her 30s. She wants to have kids, and he checks off all the boxes. He's great looking. He's Ivy League educated. He's ambitious, all these things that she's interested in. She finds out, she does an internet search, she's already married. Now, that would be a red flag. She says to him, I can't date a married person. She's very angry. He says, well, my wife, it's not working because I want to have kids right away, and she's not ready. Okay, so this takes something that should be like a disqualifying thing for Fotis and turns it into a positive, which is what like psychopaths do, which is they see what you need and they become that thing. Oh, here's a guy anxious to have kids just like me. So if you look at the timeline, that's to me the most telling thing. She finds out he's married. 4 months after she says that, he's divorced. 4 months after that, he's married to Jennifer. And then shortly after that, she's living in the middle of Connecticut. She's been in New York basically her whole life with, you know, two kids and then four kids and then five kids in under 7 years. So partly what happened is she had a fantasy about a perfect life, perfect domestic bliss. She got the house. She had all the stuff. But that's the dollhouse fantasy. And it turned out to be an illusion and unreal. And she married this very bad person. And by the time she realized it, it was too late. And she did everything right in the divorce. She protected herself. She got a restraining order. But it shows you that money really can't protect you. You think it can, but it can't. In a case like this, money might have even made it worse. Because as a lot of people said to me, if they had no money and had gone into the divorce court, this thing would have just been settled. But as it was, they had enough money to pay for lawyers and psychiatrists and all the support people for over a year. And they ended up in this situation in court that was just a nightmare. And finally, I think it felt made Fotis Doulos feel like he was justified in killing his wife.
Now the victims, of course, are the couple's five children. What do we know about how they're faring and who's looking after them?
So I think considering the circumstances, they're doing well, but the circumstances are what they are, which is the worst possible legacy you can imagine, which is their mother killed by their father himself without ever telling them what happened. So when I went to, and he was lying to the end. So when I went to court and they got up, the kids, and they spoke Michelle Tricconis, the thing that they wanted to know is what happened. They want to know where their mother's body is. They want to know what actually happened here. And I don't know if the answers will help them, but the fact is FOTUS had the ability to at least give them that, and he didn't. So he was a very selfish person. And in the end, he was a very cowardly person. And basically, everybody who came into contact with him in the later part of his life, it seems like their life was wrecked by him.
Rich, your book answers so many questions about this case, but one that remains is the question of her body. What have you learned about that since the book was published?
This is amazing because Fotis Doulos believed he was smarter than everybody in the world. That's another sign of psychopaths. And he created a very careful alibi, false. You know, he had himself in places he wasn't. He set up fake timelines. And he drove down in a car from Farmington to New Canaan that wasn't his. He changed the license plates. He didn't go straight to Jennifer's house. He parked in Waveney Park in New Canaan. And then he took a bike. He was super careful. And yet, he underestimated the police and he underestimated the technology. And he was on film. This is the reality of modern society most of the day. Because in New Canaan, you're in a very rich place and everybody has these cameras on their front porch. So they could, like putting together a jigsaw puzzle, which the police did, they basically could see where the guy was the whole entire day. Except there's two moments in the day where he's off camera. One is for about an hour in the morning, right after Jennifer is killed. This is an hour in the afternoon when he's back in Farmington. So the belief is that he has to have been gotten rid of her body in one of those two places. I have always thought that it was right after the murder, because to put her body in a car and drive it 50 miles north seemed crazy to me. And very, for a guy that was very careful, very reckless. And there were even some people who told me the police think maybe another person came in, possibly from Greece, and helped him, which is all he'd have to do is give that person Jennifer's body, and that person can go bury her anywhere in the woods in Pound Ridge or anything, and they would never find her. But I said I've heard from all these police and everything after the book came out, and they have convinced me that Fotis would put her body in a car and drive it north because he believed that he was smarter than everybody and he could talk his way out of anything, and that's just what he was like. They said absolutely believed he would do it. And a lot of the attention then turns to the woods behind Fotis's big mansion. There are these woods, I don't know how many, it's a lot of acres of woods around the Hartford reservoirs. And there's running trails and there's a reflecting pool where he used to go when he was thinking, and he'd ride his dirt bike back there and everything. So that's where my attention was drawn. And then basically I found stuff out in the course of the book tour that has very much surprised me and changed my mind and given me some new idea of where her body might be.
It's called Murder in the Dollhouse, the Jennifer Doulos story by Rich Cohen. Thank you, Rich.
Thank you so much.
Well, next up, I hate to say it, but you know, the Gwyneth Paltrow book is the biggest development of the week. I think we need to get to it.
Yes, it is the biggest development of the week. And as I said in my intro, you read it, so we don't have to.
Well, this is a biography by Amy O'Dell, who has been a fashion journalist for a long time and also wrote a biography on Anna Wintour that came out a few years ago. And this was one of those books that I read kind of in one sitting quickly. And I thought I knew everything there was to know about Gwyneth Paltrow because I've been reading People magazine and Page Six obsessively for the last 30 years. And there was a lot in there that was familiar territory, but I thought the backstory on Gwyneth's early days, especially in New York when she was a student at Spence and her relationship with her parents, like it was all very dishy and there was a lot of stuff in there that was new to me. It was a really fun part of her life to revisit because we've been hearing so much about Goop, which has been around since 2008, but we forgot really about, you know, her salad days in New York City in the 80s as a rebellious teenager ordering pizza to detention and smoking a pack of cigarettes a day and getting rejected by Vassar and making it only through one semester at University of California, Santa Barbara. So anyway, it's a really fun, interesting read. I think O'Dell did a great job of orienting Paltrow in more of a cultural context, right? We all sort of know she's a bit of a mean girl. No surprise there. She has left this trail of broken friendships in her wake. But I thought what was really interesting is how she's become this cultural phenomenon, and she was really a poster girl for big wellness before big wellness was even a thing. I mean, she was way ahead of her time in a lot of ways. And it's impossible to go back to the time before the jade egg. So this book does a really fun job of exploring how all that came together.
Do you get like, what's the key moment in her life? I mean, I'm obviously like, you win the Academy Award for Shakespeare in Love or things like that. But is like, is there a quality to her that you see is like, besides the mean girl, that accounts for her rise and dominance?
The key thing about Gwyneth is that she never stops acting, and she is really, one might say, a once in a generation type of actress. I mean, she was so good. Go back and watch movies like Shakespeare in Love and Emma and The Royal Tenenbaums. I mean, that alone would have been enough. But the fact that she has become really this salesperson for aspiration, and she has used those acting skills at every turn. And I think you can really see that in her 2023 trial. Remember when she was on trial for a ski accident? I believe it was in Utah. Yeah, it was in Deer Valley.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
I mean, that was such a key moment for her because, first of all, it was live streamed, which was unusual. So, you know, if you wanted to watch the entire thing unfold over a week or whatever it was, you could. And she was on the stand for 2 days. And it was really fascinating to watch her there as she sort of struggled to keep character. She knew exactly how she wanted to present herself and how she wanted to be seen and believed. And she couldn't help herself from sort of falling into these ridiculous tropes, you know, like the famous line that became a meme, "Well, I lost half a day of skiing." I think she's completely lost track of what it means to be a real person. And maybe it's asking too much of her to expect her to be one of those people in the first place. You know, she just comes from such a different universe and has been so famous for so long that she's sort of an avatar now for the 21st century American woman, even more so than an actual woman herself.
No, I think it's a great point you make about, I mean, you know, you always remind people like they're always acting, right? And everyone's like, oh my God, there was such a great Oscar speech. So she cried. I'm like, they've rehearsed this thing a million times. And so when she said, I'm not going to act anymore and I'm just going to be this, like, no, you're now a brand and you're the face of that brand and you're going to create a persona and a character for that. So it's always levels of, you know, manipulation and performance, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And we also learned, by the way, that that line is complete bullshit. Like, of course she's going to act again. In fact, that's something that her mother often said. And her mother, which I guess I didn't fully appreciate, Blythe Danner was really the finest stage actress of her generation. And another thing that we learned from this book is that, sort of like Tiger Woods, you know, he had observed hundreds or thousands of hours of watching his father's golf swing by the time he was 5 years old. Gwyneth really grew up at the Williamstown Theater Festival, watching her mother perform in these exquisite roles. And that really, you know, she just had a masterclass in acting from a very young age. And that probably did contribute to her great talent on screen. So it gives us a bit of insight too into how she became this, some might say superwoman, some might say avatar, some might say monster. But whatever you say or think about Gwyneth, you can't argue with the fact that she's changed the culture.
Yeah, and I just want to point out, don't forget, like, if you say you're never going to act or you're leaving acting, you know what you're doing? As a marketing person, you're creating scarcity. You're like, oh, I want this person to come back. So you just raised your bid for when you do come back. So it's all calculated at that level too. But that's just me being cynical.
No, I mean, and it's normal to be cynical about Gwyneth. I think everyone's cynical about Gwyneth. You know, is there anyone else in the public sphere that we love to hate and hate to love the way that we feel about her? I mean, she's such a polarizing character, and yet she's completely unavoidable. Over the last 30 years, I think the only person who's been less avoidable than her is Trump.
Wow, that's a sort of, you know, strange world, the two of them together. But, you know, I'll take it. We could end on that note because I think you nailed it.
Anyway, well, it's a great new book. It's called Gwyneth by Amy O'Dell. It's coming out on Tuesday. Enjoy. Okay, Michael, we can officially leave Gwyneth behind. Let's get to more pressing matters. The biggest attention whores of the week. Our colleague, George Kalogiracis, charts the ups and downs of the biggest attention whores in the universe. And he is here to take us inside the latest developments on who is annoying us the most. George is a writer at large at Airmail. Welcome, George. Well, George, I'm sorry to say, I think we have to start with Trump's approval ratings because I was talking to Alessandra Stanley, our co-editor, and she was complaining that there was no good news in the news, but it turns out you have some for us.
Well, yeah, a bunch of polls came out last week and people don't like him. And I suppose that's encouraging, but that's sort of been the case for a while. But these are pretty strong, even in areas that where he had initially had support, like immigration. Most of the Americans polled did not like what his administration was doing. So, you know, this is a guy who lives and dies by numbers, so he can't be happy about this. What it means, who knows? But yeah, I suppose a glimmer of hope.
George, one number that he does have that's really large, that's in his favor, it seems, for some people, is almost 80% of people think the Epstein file should be released. So that's a big win for him. Probably not the win he wanted. as after beating on this for 4 or 5 years. But it's I guess it's a reason why he made the Attention Whore Index this week, because he really sort of like leveraged that into some big success, right? George, one person who managed to reinsert themselves into the news, and you know, we're equal opportunity people here. Hunter Biden got back into the fray this week, right? I mean, he sort of seemed like, no, I need some attention right now, and I need to draw some attention to my father's failed campaign, right?
He's never been good at flying under the radar, and just when you hadn't really thought about him for a long time, most of us probably hadn't, there's this incredible tirade blaming Democrats and celebrity Democrats for, you know, forcing his father aside. Of course, it's always someone else's fault.
It wasn't just a blaming. He carpet bombed with F-bombs on people like George Clooney, right?
Yeah, it was. That was impressive. That was, I mean, that was a beautiful AWI moment, actually. It's what we live for around here.
I think, you know, one of the things you've added to the column, and I always look forward to, is the Santos Trophy for the Lie of the Week, which this week is a pretty great one. Speaking of Trump, right? Can you just share with us all?
Actually, I'm so glad you mentioned that, Michael, because since we started the Santos Trophy, we hadn't planned on this, but every single one, you may have noticed, has been awarded to Donald Trump because he has the most lies to choose from. The one that we chose this week is, times are different now than they were 3 or 4 years ago. We are a country, capital C, of passion and common sense. It's never hard to find one. You know, the question is, do we use this one? Do we use that one? And it's always Trump. And we're open to putting someone else up there. It just hasn't, no one's beaten him yet. It'll probably make news when the Santos Trophy goes to someone other than Donald Trump for the lie of the week.
George, does this mean that you're on Truth Social? How do you find all this stuff?
I do run around the internet a lot. I have to go to Truth Social now and then to look at what someone or other has posted, but I get out as fast as I can.
Thank God for that, George. Well, stay safe out there. Thanks for doing God's work.
Thanks. Take care.
All right, Michael, now that we've got all those nefarious characters out of the way, shall we move on to some Nazi art fraud?
Oh, yeah, please. This is like, I love this story.
So the gallerist Ezra Chowaki has seen more than his fair share of artwork, both real and fake, in his lifetime and long career. But he takes us back to a house in the suburbs of Athens in 2007, where he uncovered something he'd never seen before. Welcome, Ezra.
Hi.
Your story this week takes us back to suburban Athens in 2007, where you as an art dealer had one of the most extraordinary days of your life, but for reasons that ended up being quite different from what you initially expected. So how did you end up meeting the man named Jimmy?
Okay, so, fortunately, as Trump would say, fortunately and unfortunately, I've had plenty of extraordinary days. This was certainly one of them. So I met Jimmy. I had gone to Athens for something else entirely, and a gentleman who organized some potential business for me in Greece knew this guy Jimmy, and said, "Listen, you have to meet this guy. He's got an incredible art collection." And I know that Jimmy was reluctant to meet, but eventually he agreed. You know, it was one of those things. I don't even know Jimmy's last name. You know, I just was taken there, as happens often in the art business.
And what did you find when you walked into his warehouse? Or was it a garage?
No, it was his house. It was his house, which was a beautiful suburban mansion in Athens, or outside of Athens. It was a beautiful house.
But this then, it quickly becomes sort of like, as you write in your story, I mean, the scene is riveting because he happens to bring out a Cezanne. And so if you could just walk us through, like, and then this kind of like painting after painting by a great master comes out, and it's all, just take us through what it's like as you start to sit there.
The first impressive thing to me in the whole experience was meeting Jimmy, because Jimmy himself was quite a character. He was this kind of larger than life guy, tall, strapping guy, you know, really tan with a low voice, you know. And initially he was like, he would ask me questions about me, like, what do you know about the art, you know, whatever. And then finally he kind of took a bit of a liking to me and started saying, he started calling me a boy. He goes, "But you're just a boy. You're just a boy. What do you know if you're a boy?" You know, like that. And eventually he was comfortable enough to bring me into the house. And as soon as the door opened, the first thing I saw was a Cezanne landscape on the wall. And it was, you know, it's one of those things where I've seen a lot of art on people's walls, but it was a bit incongruous because normally for something like that, you know where you're going. You know, these are pieces, these are works that already are known, that are numbered, that, you know, people kind of have a general idea of who the collectors are, right? So to see this guy who I never heard of before in Greece, open the door and there'd be a great Cezanne there was, you know, a little bit startling. Yeah. So that was the first thing. Of course, I looked around and saw other great things.
Right. You've got a Picasso, a Kandinsky, a Matisse, Tahitian Gauguins.
Yes.
Your eyes are falling out of your head. But then he says,
right,
I've got a little problem. What is the little problem he had with his paintings?
I said, you want to sell all this? And he goes, yes, but I have a problem. Exactly right. And I said, you know, what is it? And he had been really reluctant to meet, as I mentioned. So I said, what is the problem? He said, turn it around. And he pointed at the Cezanne and I made sure that he wanted me to take it off the wall, which I did. And I looked on the back, and on the back of the painting was a stamp, an SS Nazi stamp. I mean, it took me a few seconds, but it was staring me in the face. And I was, you know, it was jarring, actually, not a little, it was quite jarring. And I looked at him and he just nodded in this kind of shameful way, you know, like, yep, that's my problem. You know, that kind of thing. He told me to take off the Van Gogh drawing that was on the wall. I did that. He told me to look at the back. It had stamps too. And it turned out that a lot, maybe, I don't know if all, but most of the stuff that he had there had these Nazi SS stamps.
And Ezra, had you ever seen anything like that before?
No. Look, I've dealt with looted Nazi art before, but, you know, it's usually on the other end. Usually it's art that has already made its way into the market. And someone's made a claim for it. And, you know, there has to be, you know, there's these processes you go through to kind of make sure that art is not looted. But I'd never seen more than one piece at a time. And certainly I never held in my hands any of it with stamps. And here was a group of them.
Well, so as you note in your story, I mean, you know, the Nazis, like, they plundered from basically two sources, museums or Jewish families, right?
Yeah, primarily, yes.
Right. And there's a way to get that art either repatriated back to the museums or back to the families who own them. So you then reach out to people to authenticate these works, right?
Right. So I had a bit of a plan. I thought, okay, look, you know, this guy really wants to get rid of this stuff. It's been weighing on him, and it was very obvious that it was a burden for him that he had for several years. So I figured I could get all of this at a really good price. Because, you know, I figured I could make him a really lowball offer and he'd probably take it.
So you show it to these experts. They all say all these paintings with the SS stamps and these Nazi ownership claims, they say the paintings are all forged, right?
It turned out that they were all fakes, which was shocking because they all had Nazi stamps on the back. I mean...
But the Nazi stamps were also part of the forgery, right?
Correct. Yes. It was... I'd never heard of anything like this. And I've seen a lot of fakes. I mean, I get offered fakes every week.
So, but I think it's important to pause here because as you note in your story, it's a classic part of any scam, which is the misdirect, right?
That's right. The misdirect. It's funny because I always say, one of my little sayings, I always say there's no Thomas Crowns, but in a way people want to be like that. You know, there is something alluring about the forbidden. And, you know, if there's more than one issue, let's say there's a, you know, we see this in politics, right? If there's an issue, the best way to distract people from that issue is to create another issue, right? If a picture is forged and has Nazi stamps, you're only going to focus on one thing at a time. So the Nazi stamps are kind of, you know, the jarring thing that you initially look at. And by the time you're done with that, you're too busy or you're too tired or whatever, you're too worn out to look at the rest of the picture. I guess that's the strategy. Because in many ways,
you know, it's like the dealer would come like, okay, this is something that someone wants to get off their hands. And it's already, but in a weird way, the Nazi ownership almost validates it because it's like, well, it must be authentic.
Absolutely.
Right?
Because if you think about it, what kind of crazy idiot would put something on the back of a painting that would make it unsellable? I mean, the Nazi stamps make these works almost unsellable, you know? So it really does lend it, like, you know, I consulted with a few lawyers at the time, and one of them was Randy Schoenberg, who was the, you know, he was the Ryan Reynolds character in The Woman in Gold with, you know, that whole story there. And Randy actually, he said he made a term up. It was something like this macabre imprimatur or something like
macabre believability.
Macabre believability, exactly. Right.
Which I think is what this whole story falls under, is macabre believability.
Absolutely. No, I've never seen anything like this.
So Ezra, how did this all resolve for you when you found out all this? What did you do?
Yeah, I ditched them as soon as possible. I called Jimmy. Now, Jimmy, I could never call him directly. I had to call him through this other guy that introduced me, you know. But I remember he got on the phone and I said, Jimmy, these are all fake. And he said, I'm sorry, Ezra. I'm sorry. You know, and I sent them back to this other guy and he gave them back to Jimmy.
Was there an element of sadness to that?
Of course there is. I mean, it's very sad, you know. But as an art dealer, I have to tell you, you get used to sad outcomes, you know, because most deals don't work out.
Fascinating story, I should say, Ezra. Thank you so much for sharing it with us.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you, guys.
There's only one place to discover a global snapshot of the current cultural scene. AIRMEL's Arts Intel Report, our international research tool for what to do and where and when to do it, is user-friendly, continuously updated, and meticulously curated. Arts Intel is handy at home, on the road, and when you're planning your next trip. It also includes indispensable lists of restaurants and hotels in key cities around the world, recommended by our well-traveled experts. Explore Arts Intel at airmail.news/arts-intel, and be sure to sign up for our weekly culture newsletter, which is published every Wednesday afternoon at airmail.news/WIC. I'm Chris Garrett, AIRMEL Deputy Editor, and I never leave home without it. Bon voyage.
Well, it is the weekend. It is time for us to immerse ourselves in culture, television, and music. I know you have something you can recommend, surely.
I do. And you know, it's almost the dog days of summer, which means you're always like, you're sort of between the big summer releases on in movies and the false prestige TV, if that still even exists. So I've been poking around. I had two procedurals that I checked out this week, and you know, sort of recommending them both in very varying degrees. The first is this one. It's number one on Netflix this week. It's called Untamed, and it stars Eric Bana. And he plays a guy who, investigator who works in Yosemite, the national park. So look, if you can't take a summer vacation and you want to see great American natural splendor, it's fantastic shots of Yosemite, El Capitan, all the great mountains there. And it concerns him trying to solve a mysterious murder/death in the park. Quite good. I'm only two episodes in. Acting's a little stilted by a couple people at times, but I'm sticking with it because I'm kind of really hooked on seeing where this goes. Speaking of procedurals, the second one is called Department Q. And this stars Matthew Good, who you probably know from Downton Abbey, as well as The Crown. Super handsome guy. And it is an adaptation of some Danish crime novels, but they've transposed it to Scotland, and the brogues are heavy, so be sure and watch it like I do with your subtitles on. But it's a great, he plays a detective who's kind of forced to head up a cold case department in this dank basement unit after getting another officer killed. So quite dark, quite strange, quite twisted. I'm a couple episodes in on that as well. So if you're looking for two things to sort of get you through the end of summer, you've got Department Q, which is streaming now on Netflix, as well as Untamed, which is also streaming on Netflix now. And you, my dear?
Well, I had one of those incredible weekends in New York last weekend. I was there by myself. My kids are at camp. My husband is traveling in Asia. And I had nothing to do except pursue pleasure. And so I went to the new Frick collection. Have you been there yet?
Unbelievable, isn't it?
Oh, so gorgeous. I mean, it's one of those perfect little museums, right? Where there, you know, there's not a huge amount of artwork. It's not totally overwhelming. And the building is, one could argue, as magnificent as some of the masterpieces. So that was an incredible pleasure. And then I saw Sorry Baby at Lincoln Square. Have you heard about this?
I've heard about it. So why don't you tell our listeners all about it?
Okay, so it was written, directed, and starred in by the actor Ava Victor. You might remember them from Billions. And it's a really wonderful tale of a graduate student in English who experiences some sort of trauma and attempts to rebuild their life in the wake of it. I thought it was beautifully acted, very well written, beautifully shot, just incredibly enjoyable. And Victor is really multi-talented. I mean, I love the way that they make you really sit with these feelings and spend 2 hours totally immersed in their world in some rural part of the East Coast. But anyway, I found it incredibly enjoyable, a major talent to watch. Victor's only 31, so lots more to come. But it's called Sorry Baby, from the screenwriter, director, director and actor Ava Victor.
All right. And it's got a cat in it.
It does have a cat in it. Yeah. It's like, of course, you're going to love the movie because of that. Okay. So, Michael, as part of my perfect New York day, I ended it at Cafe Carmelini, which is Andrew Carmelini's new-ish restaurant in the Fifth Avenue Hotel in Nomad. Have you been there?
Absolutely. Love it.
That's such a gorgeous restaurant. It had these trees in the middle. This library bar was really incredible. And I liked how there were only like 7 or 8 things on the menu, you know, but each dish was incredibly well done.
Brooke and I have gone there a few times. It's been perfect on winter evenings. It's a magnificent room. It's beautiful. It's elegant. It's quiet. You can have a nice conversation with a group of 4 or 6. And yeah, like the menu is tight in the way that you want a menu to be tight. Like, okay, it's all good things on it. What's not to love, right?
I mean, I'm still thinking about the duck tortelloni.
Yes.
That's incredible.
I give you points for eating that on a hot summer day. And that's something I usually tuck into on February night. But it's the food there is unbelievable.
Yeah, go ahead and judge me. I don't care, Michael. I clocked like 20,000 steps. I was going to the movie theater, the Frick. I had to go into the Gap, my new favorite store. Thank you, Zach Posen. It was a very busy day for me. I was famished. I needed carbs.
You deserved it.
Thank you. I feel seen. Also, by the way, did you have that mint chocolate chip ice cream? It was unbelievable at the end.
Yes.
Oh, okay. So one of our new favorite restaurants, Cafe Carmelini. Andrew, we tip a hat. Well, on that note, we wish you all a marvelous weekend. Thank you for joining us. Michael, will you please read us out?
Morning Meeting is produced by Airplay Productions and edited by Jesse Cannon. Our co-editors are Graydon Carter and Alison Stanley. Our chief operating officer is Bill Keenan. Our deputies are Ashley Baker, Chris Garrett, Nathan King, Julie Vitale, and Ash Carter. Our CMO is Emily Davis, and our music supervisor is Randall Poster. The theme music is The Cute Monster by the Buddy Collette Quintet. A new edition of AirMail is published every Saturday, so please subscribe and enjoy all of our stories on airmail.news, which we update every day. You can also find us on Twitter and Instagram at AirMail Weekly. We will be back here next Saturday with another edition of Morning Meeting, but in the meantime, be sure to subscribe at Spotify or Apple Music. But most of all, thanks again for joining us.